Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today we're going to be talking with Jean Paquette, Commissioner of the Maine Department of Labor, and Julie Rabinowitz, Director of Policy, Operations, and Communications, and everything else we want to throw in at the Maine DOL.
Thanks.
Is that good?
Yep.
All right, Julie. It's all good. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
No, it's great to have you. All right. So we've had a lot happen since the last time you were on the show back in the summertime.
Yes.
And we've had a lot of referendums that have happened. We have a lot of things that have happened just in general. So let's get down to it. How's that?
Sure.
All right. Let's start with question one that passed, or even with the recount. Looks like it's passed because it's going to be more fun than one should be allowed.
Right, right. Mm-hmm.
Recreational marijuana. Where do you see this impacting employers, especially when it comes to two areas, drug testing and having it on their locations specifically?
So there's two pieces in the language of the bill of the referendum that specifically refer to employment. There, if you looked up the bill, they're at the bottom of page 27 and the top of page 28. You can tell we've looked at them a lot.
They're right on the ballot. I saw them.
Right.
Yes,
so point two talks about the employer's ability to restrict marijuana in the workplace, meaning in their facility. They can say you can't smoke it, you can't grow it, you can't have it. When we looked at that in the workplace, there's some questions about where the words in the workplace are in the sentence to see whether it's modifying, is your parking lot the workplace? So those are the kinds of questions that aren't really issues for drug testing per se, but might hold implications on the unemployment side of the house. If you dismiss someone for using marijuana in their car on your property, is that in the workplace if they are not on the clock? So those are some questions that the wording of the language kind of opens up that we have to look at.
So currently, let's talk practical stuff here. So if somebody comes to work, let's start at the beginning. Somebody comes to work and they bring with them marijuana. And so I think we're probably going to have to separate medical marijuana and marijuana because recreational versus medical,
well,
right?
But the employer can still say you can't have medical marijuana on you when you're at work.
So
either.
This doesn't change
so,
that.
So that part doesn't really change.
Okay.
What really changes is when we're looking in the unemployment world, not in the drug testing world, but in the unemployment world, you know, part of what we're looking at is patterns of behavior. Has the employer treated all the employees fairly and equally, equitably? Are they following their policy manuals? So, and is it negligence on the part of the worker for the way that they are handling the interests of the employer? So if you're smoking recreational marijuana in your car, in the parking lot, and you leave, it's after your shift, but the video camera in the parking lot catches you doing this, is that in the workplace? And that's what's not clear in the referendum.
So would the question then be, does the employer own the parking lot? Does the employer
let's take a different
lot?
Say you're construction and you don't
work on
the employer's workplace, you work at someone else's workplace doing the construction activities. So is that considered in the workplace? Because the owner only really has discretion over their property. So is it referring to property or wherever the work is performed? So if you're saying it's where the work is performed, then it might not be the parking lot. But if you're saying it's the property, then it might not be that other work site that's not owned by the employer.
Right. So I think what we're looking at now is the department is all of these pieces and trying to pull out what's very confusing for employers. And then what will happen ultimately is when the new session comes into play, you'll see a lot of lots of legislation will probably be introduced, I'm assuming, that will get at these very points, because right now it's nebulous and we don't necessarily have any cases to back it up.
Right,
so
right.
So it is about how do we take this referendum question and tear it apart and put the different scenarios to them and then say what would make sense and what would be hopefully nonpartisan to get it clearer
right.
for people.
And that second subpoint also refers to being impaired in the workplace. And that's where we get into the issues around drug testing. And the point three, which runs from 27 over to page 28 in that section, and this is setting up new law under the marijuana legalization law. It doesn't edit or amend any of Title 26, which is the Department of Labor's employment regulations. So it's really throwing a wrench into things because it's not fixing existing law and then adding this component. It's just adding this component into a mix of other laws that may or may not complement or work together nicely. So when we look at impairment, then we start looking at how do we assess impairment? How does that intersect with drug testing? And what do you do with applicant drug testing versus employee drug testing? Now, we've been concerned at the department about the issue of impairment for several years, particularly stemming out of medical marijuana, but also
right.
the opiate epidemic and abuse of prescription drugs, or just people taking prescription drugs correctly,
sure.
but it having an impairing effect and potentially a problem with safety in the workplace. So we want to enable employers to have a better understanding of what constitutes impairment, how to recognize impairment. So we have added a training class to our SafetyWorks program, which SafetyWorks is part of the Bureau of Labor Standards. It is a consultative and training program. It's confidential. They do on-site inspections to help consultations. Enforcement's an inspection and assistance. The consultation is really an assistance. But they'll walk through and see, you know, what are your safety hazards?
Sure.
If we were
sure.
OSHA coming through, what would your fine be? That then we help you correct it. It's confidential and it doesn't get sent to OSHA. But we also have a training component with that, and we offer all the classes at no cost to employers. Most of them are located in Augusta, but we do them in other parts of the state. And we are partnering with DHHS and their Center for Disease Controls, the CDC, as well as the Department of Public Safety to bring together and bring to Maine an impairment class that will not only help employers who need to provide training to those individuals who have to meet the U.S. Department of Transportation training requirements for managing drug tests and assessing impairment, but also will just be more helpful in this environment, particularly now with legalization of marijuana, but including these other drug issues that we've been having in the state to kind of recognize what the symptoms are of impairment in the workplace.
No, I think that's a critical step because employers have said for years, what does impairment really mean and how do you really define it and how do you really look at it and understand how somebody is or is not impaired? I mean, heck, you can be impaired, as we talked about last week, if somebody's not been sleeping for 3 or 4 days.
Right.
Right? I mean, impairment is really, you know, not behaving the right way for the job. Right, and not being able to do your job because of something
right.
that is affecting that, whether it's legal,
right.
illegal, it's the impairment side of it. And so managers, because they're not doctors, they're not nurses, right?
Exactly.
Have to understand how to use that effectively.
And it really gets down to looking at fitness for duty. Can you do the job that you've been assigned to perform safely? And are you feeling also that your workplace is supportive? If you go to your boss and say, you know, I just got these pain meds because I had some dental work done yesterday evening and I really can't be on this machine today, whether I need to take sick time or whether I need to just be reassigned to a different duty for the days that I'm on that painkiller. But it goes beyond that when we talk about marijuana, because marijuana, unlike most other drugs, and definitely unlike alcohol, which is kind of the irony, this referendum was marketed, you know, to regulate it like alcohol. But alcohol leaves your system within 24 hours and you don't test positive for it. Marijuana, you can test positive for a month to 6 weeks. And if you're a heavy user, the likelihood is that you will test positive more and longer.
So let me give you two scenarios that have come up, and one has to do with the drug testing, one has to do with just somebody who comes to work impaired. So let's say somebody comes to work and they're drunk. Let's just use this as an initial scenario. If somebody comes to work drunk, a lot of policies state that they will be terminated. Okay, that's what the policy says. You come to work drunk, you'll be terminated. Mm-hmm. Okay, now there's a whole bunch of other things. I'm being a little simplistic, but let's say you come to work, you are drunk as a skunk, and you will be terminated, period.
Mm-hmm.
Would it be proper to say that if somebody comes to work extremely high, completely out of it, because they were smoking marijuana, should they be treated the same way as someone who comes to work drunk? Can they be terminated?
Under the terms of the referendum, yes, that they cannot be impaired at the work site. But the question then becomes, how are you, you know, in the unemployment side, are you always treating people the same way?
Well, and
how
are you using the assessment to... That's the question.
But how are you assessing impairment?
Right.
You know, and that gets to, I could use a breathalyzer to tell you're drunk. I can smell your breath. I can look at you physically. I can smell maybe marijuana on you, but I don't have a way of doing that breathalyzer. So I have to look at other signs and symptoms.
Could you send them to a, again, this goes to drug testing, right? Because Maine's drug testing is extremely restrictive. We know that.
Oh, yes.
Right? She's like, yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we know that's extremely
restrictive.
That's
a loose...
So could if you sent them for a fitness for duty test, mm-hmm. at that point, you say you appear to be impaired, you appear to be not able to do the job because of your you know, really kind of acting high, and we've defined what that may be, and then the test comes back that says, from the doctor's perspective, yes, you are on marijuana. How's that different than terminating somebody from alcohol?
Well, you couldn't do a blood test to make that determination of what drug they were on unless you had a drug testing policy. And most employers in the state don't have a drug testing policy or a state-approved drug testing policy, or might fall under the limits or fall into the exception if they do have a drug testing policy, because there's a lot of loopholes in the way Maine's drug testing policy is written.
There is. And is that still going to be worked on, I'm assuming, for 2017? You're hoping to reintroduce the bill to fix that, I'm hoping.
We're working on that.
Okay.
But just to mention the impairment workshop, we have one scheduled for January 25th, 2017. So if people want to find out about signing up for that, if we do have an overflow, we possibly will offer additional workshops for that, but you can go
online. Great, and we'll certainly put that out to make sure everybody knows about that. Are you taking that on the road? Are you going to do one in the southern part of the state, one in the northern part of the state?
We usually do those kinds of workshops.
And if employers want to bring that on site, they can still do it through Safety Works.
Yep.
So you do it on site for employers if they're interested, or associations if they're interested.
That's a good way to do it, with the associations.
And how long do you anticipate that program being? Is it 2 hours, 1 hour?
It's actually
half day.
It's 8:30 to 3:30, I believe.
For a full day.
Mm-hmm.
6 hours.
It needs to meet the federal as well as the extra information to deal with the legalized marijuana piece. So it's has to meet that minimum time.
Okay. That's fine. I'm just trying to make sure employers understand.
And we want to have it meet those multiple requirements so that you don't have to go sit through two different drug testing impairment kinds of classes.
No, that's great. And that's great information. We'll make sure that it gets out there. We're talking with Jean Paquette, Commissioner of the Maine Department of Labor, and Julia Rabinowitz, Director of Policy Operations and Communications. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis, as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's jacksonlewis.com.
Yeah, And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, a News Talk WLOB, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. Today, we're talking with our friends from the Maine Department of Labor, Commissioner Gene Paquette and Julie Rabinowitz, Director of Policy, Operations, Communications, and everything else Gene tells her to be in charge
That's
of.
That's exactly it.
Whatever Gene says is what
That's
I
right.
do. That's good. That's all right, Gene.
Yeah, works out really well.
I love that. Well, we're talking about question one, the first referendum that passed here in the state of Maine about the recreational use of marijuana and how it's going to be affecting employers here. And we talked a lot about, you know, actually having a physical possession of it on property and what that means and some of the questions that are still out there. Let's talk about hiring. So, and that may or may not involve drug testing. Talk to us about the law and what the law says and what it actually means.
So the law says that it bans discrimination by landlords and educational institutions and employers, and it says that an employer may not refuse to employ or otherwise penalize someone solely for using recreational marijuana. Now, when we do our drug testing, the vast majority of employers in the state are doing applicant drug testing, and about 5% of those are positives, and 82% of that 5%, so 82% of positives are positive for marijuana. So that's without it being legalized and available at bars or in social clubs. So we expect that number to increase, but then what do you do with the drug test results? Because now you can refuse to employ someone solely for testing positive on that drug test.
So would it be correct to say that you still can?
Well, I think the question comes down to what the definition of solely of is. And employers need to know that if they are doing a drug test and the offer of employment is going to be contingent upon passing that if the individual has quit their previous job in order to take this job and they show up on day one and the employer says, well, you've got to pass the drug test before we formally hire you, and they fail that drug test, that worker may be entitled to unemployment. So there's an unemployment piece that's tied to drug testing that's really not something that the employer's thinking that they could be liable for.
So let's back up for a second here. So if I'm a applicant and I come in and I let's be clear, this is non-federal positions. We want to make sure we start with drivers and things that are federal drivers, truck drivers.
And the day after this referendum passed, Wednesday morning, USDOT was looking at the Maine Department of Labor's website and called us about our drug testing laws. They're very concerned about people being impaired driving commercial vehicles.
Well, that's correct. That's the big
question.
They
should be,
right?
Yes.
Right, because not all drivers here in the state are DOT drivers.
Right.
Right? I mean, you could just drive for a business.
Right.
Go to a client, you know, in any mm-hmm. business.
Right.
And so you're driving for business at that point.
Exactly.
And so, you know, employers are concerned that, hey, what if during that drive somebody lights up a cigarette or a marijuana cigarette, and then they get to the other side of wherever they're going, and who's liable if they get in an accident, and how does that all work in terms of employers? And these are legitimate questions to
right.
ask.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So how that plays out. So any guidance that you could give us in that type of that aspect?
Well, the commissioner and I visited Denver in June, and we also had the person in the Colorado governor's office, their marijuana legalization czar, if you will, come to Maine in July and speak to not only staff from the Maine Department of Labor, but the commissioner's fellow, other commissioners of labor from across the country.
So when we went out to Colorado, we were out there for another reason, but we had a chance to meet with their director of their workers' comp system. So it wasn't necessarily who is in charge of unemployment or the Department of Labor, but he seemed to be the one that had the most knowledge about it because of the workers' comp aspect of all of this as well. So when we met with him, it was very clear to both Julie and I that the difference between how Colorado operates and how Maine will be operating is that there is a lot more teeth for employers in their laws so that they can have a drug-free workplace.
That's in Colorado.
That's in Colorado.
Yeah.
So when you're talking to them about what grounds they can have a policy that says, I will have a drug-free workplace, and they have different – in fact, I think there's five different ways that you can terminate an employee and still be not – stepping on anyone's rights
with
or anything
testing.
Like that with drug testing and
yep.
things like that. So I think that's something that it would be very important for your audience and people, you know, that are interested business owners to really look at. What are some of those laws that possibly we could also replicate, which would protect employers so that they can have a drug-free workplace?
No, it's a big issue.
Having the flexibility to define how you want to consider yourself a drug-free workplace as an employer, so it allows you to make exceptions for medical marijuana or to
yeah.
make exceptions for prescription drugs or to allow an employee to, you know, the flexibility to come to you and tell you when they're on a medical marijuana or on a prescription drug and do that, you know, change of duties and really consider fitness of duty. But the biggest challenge for the state of Maine is that the current drug testing loopholes that we have, the most effective type of drug testing that we had in the state, our research has shown that shows statistically the lowest or the flat, no increase in positive drug tests is random testing. We only allow random testing for businesses with 50 or more employees. Well, 90% of the businesses in Maine have 20 or fewer employees. So right there, we're restricting the most effective tool in terms of keeping employees clean. And when we talk about things like the heroin epidemic, when you're hiring someone who's in recovery, it may just be that the thought of a random drug test is something that's extra thing that helps keep them clean and in recovery.
Well,
yeah.
I think that's a really good point because first of all, I think that when the original drug testing laws were put in place, they didn't account for the thought of all this happening.
Right,
right.
And I think that they have become antiquated, albeit they're already restrictive. We really do need – that's probably the biggest thing that I see and employers would see, and pontificating a little here, as to the real challenge, as mm-hmm. to how to control the workplace, how to control the safety – of the people there, how to control the safety of people doing things and ensuring that they're clean in terms of doing
right.
work each
right.
and every day. Nobody cares what they're doing at home. Employers don't care. It is what it is. But when it comes into the workplace, it really is a big deal in terms of making that happen.
And when you're talking about someone on a multimillion-dollar piece of equipment or using something that's dangerous or endangering a patient or a client or another coworker, that's when no one wants to send someone home without a finger.
Well, the other question
and they don't want anyone to get hurt on the job.
Let's say an accident happens, mm-hmm. and OSHA is federal. Right.
Right.
So if something happens and there's an accident, God forbid a tragedy or something to that effect, what's the liability of the employer having to do with the fact that they may have allowed somebody using a federally illegal drug having to do with that? I mean, there's a real question.
Well, the irony is that OSHA actually is trying to put out, and this may change, which with the new change in administrations, they've delayed the implementation of this. It was supposed to be implemented in the summer, and they've pushed it off until after the new administration steps in. They don't like drug testing because they think that drug testing masks people reporting unsafe conditions or injuries. So we're stuck between a rock and a hard place because we see value in some drug testing being able to be conducted, whether it's random, whether it's after an accident. They don't like the after an accident drug testing, which is kind of ironic because USDOT is all about post-accident
sure.
Drug testing.
Right.
To really get at what the cause of the accident was. So OSHA feels that the drug testing may be a deterrent from someone reporting a near miss or an accident, because then they could get terminated for the drug testing. So you have to demonstrate that your drug testing as an employer to OSHA is not deterring people from reporting accidents.
Gene, you have so much fun up there at the main DMR. So much
well,
fun.
Well, I'm just so lucky to have such a great team to be able to dig into these weeds. And, you know, what we've tried to do all along over the last 5-6 years is really trying to get the people around the table that need to be around the table, get some legislation that would be nonpartisan or bipartisan, get it in front of the legislators, and we hope that this next session we will be able to work together to get some really important legislation passed. So we encourage your audience and everyone else that we go out and speak to. We're trying to demystify it. We're trying to make our website as clear as possible, but there still is so much in flux right now that we need everyone to stay on top of this. So I really appreciate you having this kind of a program so that we can talk about these things, but we have to continue it. It's not just a one-shot deal. Passed, and now what is going to happen? And, you know, Colorado, Governor Hickenlooper even admitted when he was on 60 Minutes a couple months ago, he said that if we were to do it over again, you know, he would encourage states to hold off until there's more data that can help look at things like workplace, things like that. So,
well, as we all know, this is really about the money. This is about the tax revenue, and that's being honest, and that's what it's
really
about. And that's
But this referendum is only talking about 10%. Tax as opposed to 35% in Colorado. So it's very different.
It's pretty low
here
in comparison.
Pretty low.
Though I don't know if you've heard, there's been some scuttle about having municipalities tax it locally.
It does allow that, but I think that there had to be some other amendment to the local option sales tax piece to allow that to happen. I don't think they could just amend it for marijuana. I might be mistaken, but I think that was the case.
Okay.
There was also a few weeks back an announcement that Portland was going to be putting a moratorium on record to give 6 months to really study this and look.
Yeah, you've seen that across the state, is that people are just putting it on the pause button as they try to figure out what this all means.
Yes.
And I think more regulations have to come out to clarify the regulations that are out having to do with this bill.
Right.
And so forth.
In Colorado, the reason why they put a marijuana czar in the governor's office is because they realized that the legalization touched about 10 different state agencies. So even though the law itself might only be mostly this is going to be an ag and there's a little bit in DHHS, the law that affects employment isn't assigned to the Department of Labor, but we know where it will play out is in the unemployment system and in the drug testing system. So they didn't have to amend our statute to make it happen and affect all those other programs.
Okay, great. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB. We're talking with Commissioner of the Maine Department of Labor, Gene Paquette, and Julie Rabinowitz, Director of Policy, Operations, and Communications. And we will be right back.
At 154 years old, Verrill Dana has an illustrious history and more than 7 generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across 7 offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill Dana serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill Dana, one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact them today at verrilldana.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. And today we're talking with the one, the only, Gene Paquette, Commissioner of the Maine Department of Labor, and the one that does it all.
Thanks.
Julie Rabinowitz, Director of Policy, Operations, and Communications. I don't know how much better I can make it, guys. Really.
It's good.
I mean
you're doing great.
You know, who's going to be the next czar of cannabis here in Maine? Is it, are you going to take on that role?
No.
I'm just asking. But if you listen to the last segment, you would understand that question because we talked about that there is a czar of marijuana in Colorado. I'm sure they'll be taking applications at the Maine DOL soon for that.
Yeah.
Just stand by. Stand
yep,
by.
That's right.
All right. We've talked about the cannabis and marijuana question, which I thought was interesting that they kept interchanging the word between mm-hmm. the bill. Wasn't interesting? Mm-hmm. But let's talk about minimum wage.
Okay. So minimum wage.
Going to $9 an hour.
$9
January
an hour.
1st, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Though, to be honest with you, I don't think it's going to affect too much because McDonald's is paying $11.9 already.
Well, in different parts of the state, there was a McDonald's I passed down in Wells a couple weeks ago, and they were paying $9, and the McDonald's in Falmouth is paying $11. So it's, you know, regional variation. Obviously, the Portland minimum wage right now being $10.10 drives up the areas around
and
it.
And Bangor has a...
So Bangor has a local ordinance that was not to take effect until January 1, but right. I believe it was only going to $8 or $8.50. So the state law, we've already looked at that and posted information on the website. The state referendum will... Trump, to use a political word now, will trump the local minimum wage in Bangor. So the Bangor ordinance will not really take effect. But in Portland, there's a little complication because when we look at the minimum wage law, we're always looking at what's most protective for the worker. So the state minimum wage will be $9. The Portland minimum wage will be $10.68. And so in Portland, the Portland minimum wage will still be the minimum wage.
So it's going from $10.10 to $10.68.
Mm-hmm. And for the tip credit, which was part of the bill, and there was a lot of discussion about how the tip credit works and how it would affect the restaurant industry, there's the direct wage that the employer is mandated to pay, which right now is half the state minimum wage. And the state minimum wage is $7.50, so half of that's $3.75, and then the employer takes the other as a credit against the tips that the restaurant worker has earned, the right. server, the bartender, and then that credit, as long as they've earned enough tips to make at least the minimum wage, the employer doesn't have to balance out and meet the minimum wage. They just pay the direct wage of $3.75. But if it was a snowy week or a rainy week at the beach, and they did not earn enough in tips, the employer is obligated to ensure that they earn at least the minimum wage. So the direct wage will be going up to $5 an hour as a result of the referendum. So throughout the state, every employer who's using the tip credit will be mandated to pay a direct wage of $5 an hour. In Portland, they will have to pay the direct wage of $5 an hour, which is the state direct wage, and not the direct wage that's in the local ordinance. So in Portland, it's a little more confusing because they're going to be paying the local minimum wage, but the state direct wage if they have been using the tip credit.
And that's a big deal here in Portland because we have a lot of restaurants.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
A lot of restaurants here in Portland. So that can be confusing for somebody. Okay, so then it goes up $1 a year till 2020.
Right, right.
Correct?
To 12.
And then it attaches to the CPI.
Yes.
Yes. Do you want to talk about that?
I'm hoping somebody will fix that because the CPI is so... Don't even get me started.
So we've done some simulations, and I think what's important to think about is when the minimum wage hits $12 and starts adjusting to the CPI, it will be a percentage of the previous year's minimum wage. So say the CPI is 1% and the minimum wage is $12 in 2020. So in 2021, if it's 1%, you have to round it to the nearest nickel. So that'd be 12 cents. So 12 cents rounded to the nearest nickel would be 10 cents. So it's 12.10. If it's, say, 2% the next year, that would be 25 cents because it would be 24 cents rounded to the nearest nickel, which would be 25 cents. So then the minimum wage would be 12.10 plus 25, so it'd be 12.35. But as that percentage increases, that CPI is not on $12 every year. It's on the growing minimum wage.
Right. No, it just continues
to grow. So the percentage continues to grow.
Right.
So
what happens, by the way, is just a point of reference if it's a negative CPI.
Well, they don't get the money taken away. I guarantee you that. Yeah. They're so not going to give people.
It just says rounded to the nearest 5 cents.
It would probably stay the same. And I think what you're going to see in this next session, you're going to see that addressed through legislation here in the state. And I think you're also going to see the tip credit being challenged.
Yeah, because that is really those two issues.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think anybody's concerned about the $9 minimum wage, to be honest with you. Yes, I understand that it's, you know, for summertime and all that. Nobody's really paying that anywhere unless you're talking about seasonal help.
No, the market's right? taking care the market's of that
solved,
anyway.
Has already solved the problem. I am concerned about this continuation. It's almost the same as we have talked about previously, which we're not talking about today because we've talked about it before, about how we're just going to keep every 3 years on the exempt salary continue to increase.
Right.
I mean, it's the same thing. It's just it's an arbitrary figure, an arbitrary number that doesn't have a lot of meaning behind it.
Right.
Because who can predict in 2020 what the CPI will look like?
Exactly.
That's what's difficult because then you're pricing out your less experienced workers with a continually increasing minimum wage. When we did a simulation to try to project out when the direct wage with the phasing out of the tip credit will reach parity with the minimum wage, one of our projections has it with pretty reasonable low CPI numbers was not until 2027. So that's really confusing because you're building in unpredictability and a lot of work for the employer and also a lot of work for the department because every year things change when we're auditing books, we look back. It just adds a layer of complexity that, sure. You know, we only have 1.3 million people.
Right, right. Well, I mean, yeah. those are the concerns that most employers have. It's not a fact that they have to, I mean, it's easy. You just make the change and you keep in touch. But there is this uncertainty of where it's going, and businesses need certainty.
Yes.
Plan and project.
Exactly.
And that's what we're really talking about to make that happen.
That's right.
Is there anything else we need to know about that law in terms of minimum wage? Anything else that we should be aware of?
So if employers have any questions, they can call 623-7900 and speak to the Wage and Hour Department, and they can answer those questions. We also have information on our website, and you can link to it if you go to maine.gov/labor, and we have the current required minimum wage posted on that site, and there's links right there to take you to more information on the state. And we will have posters. Everyone wants the posters, and the posters are free. You can print them off from the Department of Labor's website. You don't have to buy them and spend money on them. If you want the nice big laminated one where all the posters are one laminate, that you do have to buy because we don't provide that.
Well, and also just most payroll companies, if you use like ADP or Paychex, then they'll provide it for no cost.
Yeah.
So just and the one of posters. So that we know is going to be happening across the board. Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing, the good news I have heard, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but unemployment numbers are going down in terms of what employers have to pay into the unemployment fund. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. We just sent the letters out to all employers and employers overall are saving $15 million this year in unemployment tax. So we are really, with all of the referendums, the minimum wage and all, we still have to stay competitive. So this is good news about the unemployment rates. A lot of that is the fact that unemployment has gone down. But we still need to make sure that every person is in the labor force, and we've got a lot of work to do around that as well. So we need more workers so that employers are paying more unemployment tax because there's more workers, not because of their rate going up for other reasons.
No, you're absolutely correct. And you're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM, 100.5 FM. And we'll be right back. And now your HR Tip of the Week. Your HR Tip of the Week is being sponsored by VeralDana.com.
Hi, this is Doug Currier from VeralDana. We've all heard the adage, when you assume, you make an ass out of you and me. My experience representing employers for over 25 years is that assumptions can get you into a lot of trouble. No jury is going to like it if you took some action against an employee and you had your facts wrong. And if you do not take the time to find out the facts, to ask the right questions, to give the employee a chance to fully explain his or her side of the story, then the same jury might conclude that you really did not care about the facts, perhaps because you wanted to have some excuse to get rid of the employee for some other, perhaps illegal reason. So do not assume the facts. Ask the who, what, where, when, why, and how, and push back when something doesn't add up. For further insights and advice, feel free to reach out to Verrill and Dana's Labor and Employment Law Group.
And that's your HR Tip of the Week, sponsored by VerrillDana.com. And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and Maine.DaleCarnegie.com. And today we're talking with Julie Rabinowitz and also with Jean Paquette, both from the Maine Department of Labor, and we're having a great conversation. But you know what, Julie, we're going to be talking about right now the Fair Labor Standards Act. As you know, recently a federal judge has ruled that it is going to be put on hold pending a review, I guess is the best way to put it. Where is this standing at this point? How does this affect us? And where do you see this going?
So on the Tuesday before Thanksgiving, a federal judge granted an injunction preventing the new federal overtime rules for who can be an exempt from overtime worker from going into effect. The main change was going to require basically a doubling of the minimum salary threshold for employers to pay anyone who was exempt from overtime. And we at the department have been doing quite a lot of work since those rules were announced in May, giving employers just a bit more than 6 months to come into compliance for this December 1st deadline. So the injunction was really a last-minute prevention of the rules from going into effect. The lawsuit was brought by 21 states, including Governor LePage representing himself because the Attorney General had declined to put Maine in as one of the 21 states, but we were included in that. And then also a group of businesses, and the judge had combined the two lawsuits. And his ruling granting the temporary injunction essentially came down to USDOL in privileging the salary threshold over the other two parts of the test for an overtime exempt worker, which is to be paid by salary and a guaranteed salary, and then also to meet the duties test, which I know you've covered on the show many, many times, but for executive, professional, and administrative duties test, that it privileged the salary over those other two things, particularly the duties test, and that was not what Congress had intended under the Fair Labor Standards Act originally when they created this overtime-exempt salary kind of position. So that has thrown a lot of employers into kind of a spin because they had already made the changes in their staffing model and in their salary structures to accommodate the new threshold. And some of that had included making some people who were salary hourly and making some people who were salary bumping them up to the higher threshold, but expecting that they were going to take on extra work, you know, more overtime that those other hourly now eligible for overtime workers were not going to do, or were only going to be able to do limited amounts of overtime and things like that. So it was quite a shock to the system. But it still could go into effect because USDOL has appealed the judge's ruling and they have scheduled the amicus brief filing throughout the next several weeks in December and into January, and they've scheduled the hearing for January 31st. What throws another wrench into it is what the final position of the Trump administration will take, because USDOL under the Obama administration is supporting these rules. So all the briefs and everything that they're filing in this case is supportive of the rules. It's likely that the Trump administration would not be supportive of the rule in its entirety or parts of the rule. So that all is left to play out.
Julie, you know, I understand that that's going to be reviewed shortly. Do we know when the ruling might come down from the court?
Since the hearing would probably be January 31st, it could be sometime in February. The Trump administration could refuse to defend the rule when it gets to that hearing. So we could know as of the hearing date what will happen. It cannot be overturned by executive order. It can be thrown out by the court, or it can be rescinded through another rulemaking process under the Trump administration, or it could be overruled by an act of Congress to just create a different threshold and amend those overtime exempt salary thresholds and those kinds of things through an act of Congress that would have to be signed by then President Trump.
All right, so let me ask you this question. So let me break this down, and then we'll talk about Maine in a minute because Maine has its own issue going on. But let me just stay with the Fed for just a few seconds. So if a employer currently today has made the changes and is kind of like on standby, if you want to call it, you know, waiting to see where it goes, what is the recommendation of the Maine Department of Labor about employers that are thinking to themselves, well, if I don't have to do this, maybe I should just put it all back to where it was?
I would just wait, because we don't know what the judge is going to do. I mean, we can think that his position was written pretty tightly, but rather than undo it and then have to redo it, say Congress comes back and they throw out most of the rule in an amendment to the Fair Labor Standards Act, but they do increase the salary a little bit, or just not as much as what was proposed in the rule, then employers are still going to have to comply with that. And if they hold tight, they will be prepared for whatever comes down the road. And then when they hire someone new, if it doesn't go into effect, they can reinstate those employees they might have removed from salary. They can reinstate them back to salary, and they can also hire new hires at the salary level that they think is appropriate for the duties that they've been assigned, as long as those duties fall underneath those categories. But what we don't want to see is this continuing yo-yo where you do all the work to comply and then you don't have to comply, so you let it go, and then you have to do a bunch more work to comply. It's not good for the employer. It's a waste of their precious time and resources, and it is not good for the employee either.
All right, so I'm just going to push back. I agree with you 100%, by the way, that you know what it is. You've made the decision, stick with it. But is it against the against the law for them to, if they make the decision that the court comes back and it says we're not going to do this, and that this is, or the administration says this is not going to be done, and they want to push things back, is there anything that says that they can't?
No. In Maine, we do have some laws around like the amount of wages you're paying someone, whether that's by salary or by the hour, that you have to give at least 24 hours notice, and some other kinds of provisions like that. But as long as they meet those other provisions, they could reinstate those employees to their previous positions, subject to a couple key items, which we'll get to next.
Sure. And I think the only reason I ask is because, as you know, there were a number of employees who were actually very upset that they had to go from salary back to an hourly position. And so in some cases, not all, in some cases, there may be employers that actually say, hey, guess what? Good news. You can go back to being the salary level you were before because this didn't take place. And that's the only way I look at it and say that. As I agree, you know, to have a yo-yo effect for employees is very difficult. But in some cases, employers may determine that their employee was much, much happier when they were at the salary level because they, you know, they perceived themselves as being the flexibility and all those things that go along with it. And so I just thought I'd ask to make sure there isn't any specific thing that precludes them from doing that.
No, and we would just advise that they check with their HR consultant or their employment attorney just to make sure that they have all their ducks in a row. Now, the other piece is, though, if you're doing your evaluation as an employer of the duties test, have individuals that you realize were misclassified as an exempt worker and should not have been, do not reinstate those employees unless you change their duties.
Of course, that makes perfect sense. All right, now let's talk about the state of Maine, because we had the Maine minimum wage rule go into effect with the passage of, gosh, I want to say it was question two, and no, I'm sorry, question four.
Question
four, that's all right. And so because of that, we all know, we talked about it obviously on the show here, we talked about what's going to happen with that, but it also affects salary-exempt salaries here in Maine. So explain that.
Because there was so much discussion about the federal overtime-exempt salary workers, in the working assumption that was that that was going to go into effect on December 1st. During the minimum wage debate, it was not made clear that Maine has its own laws that tie the minimum wage to the salary-exempt level. And we have laws that require that an employer pay 3,000 times the state minimum wage to any salary exempt from overtime worker who meets the administrative, professional, and executive duties tests, or whatever is in federal law, whichever is higher. Now, the federal overtime rule was going to be higher, so it never really became an issue. But now that the injunction has been put in place and the minimum wage has been passed, increasing it, when we multiplied $9 times 3,000, we end up with $27,000 a year, which is higher than the current federal threshold of around $23,500. $7.50, the state minimum wage, until the end of 2016, basically, is just under $23,500. So it never rose to the level where there's ever been a discussion about this provision of the law, because the federal law has always trumped, to use a no pun intended, trumped the state law. So now we have a situation where the minimum wage is going to rise every year for the next 4 years, up to $12 an hour, and then tied to the CPI, the Consumer Price Index, after that. And every time it changes, the salary exempt threshold will have to change under state law until the feds change it to a level that is higher than the state. So this is definitely something that was completely under the radar. The department, we were very limited in our positions we could take on the minimum wage, and with the confusion around the federal overtime rule, throwing this in the mix was challenging, just to get people to understand the different parts of the minimum wage referendum, the tip credit, the CPI adjustment, the raising of the wage itself, and then having this other component that was not on the ballot or part of the bill, but is buried in other parts of the wage and hour laws.
So basically, what is the weekly rate that an exempt salaried individual here in Maine needs to be making sure that they are made as of January 1, 2017?
Well, it's going to be $519.24. And actually, it's not even January 1, even though that's what the statute says. Because the election was pretty late this year, in November was the 8th, the law requires 30 days after the governor certifies the election before a law can go into effect. So technically, the minimum wage law and this salary exemption threshold, minimum salary threshold, don't go into effect until January 7th.
Yeah, so pretty much you're going to make it as of the 1st to be safe.
So pretty much make it as of the 1st, but they won't be required by law until the 7th.
Got it.
Well, it couldn't be more confusing, could it?
No. We love this. This is what keeps you guys busy and keeps us very, very busy here. You know, we're talking with Julie Rabinowitz, Director of Policy Operations and Communication for the Maine Department of Labor, along with Jean Paquette, Commissioner of the Maine Department of Labor. This has been a fascinating section. Certainly, we'll be talking more about it as we continue with the show. Julie, thank you very much. We'll be moving forward.
Thank you so much, Dave. We're happy to have these conversations with you anytime.
We're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM and 100.5 FM. Thank you for listening, and catch us every week at 10 AM on News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM, or streaming live on WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at HRPowerHour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.